Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 65 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. Today I want to interview a man who's studied viruses for a long time, for more than a decade, focusing on the scientific evidence that many so-called viral diseases actually have environmental causes, if we define the environment broadly to mean all the chemicals we come in contact with through our food, air, water, the substances we ingest, inject, or inhale for medical or recreational purposes in the course of a job or in other aspects of life. That man is David Crowe. Welcome to the show, David. Well, thanks for having me today. I'm very pleased to be here. Now, in the world of viruses, what are you going to talk about today? Well, I'd like to talk about the polio field trial. The polio field trial, that was way back in the 1950s. What's new in polio? Well, it's true, it was in the 1950s, but it's still very important, and it has not been properly analyzed because there's a lot of problems with it. Are you crazy? The polio field trial was 1950-something. The vaccine worked, it eliminated polio in America anyway, and as the vaccine's being rolled out around the world, it has virtually eliminated polio around the world, and they're now down to a few hundred cases a year. I mean, maybe there were some problems with the polio field trial, but get real, it's over. Well, actually, that's not true. You could ask me how many polio cases there are around the world, and using World Health Organization statistics, I could give you two different answers. So go ahead, ask me. Okay, so how many polio cases are there around the world? Well, around 2011, the number of cases of polio, according to World Health Organization statistics, hit 100,000. No, that's not possible. We all know that polio's virtually been eliminated. Okay, well, ask me again. Ask me how many cases of polio there are around the world. Okay, how many cases of polio are there around the world according to World Health Organization statistics? Well, just a couple of hundred. Now, wait a minute. A minute ago you said 100,000. Now it's a couple of hundred. Like, what's the truth? Well, were you asking me about polio the virus or polio the disease? Which one do you really want to know about? Well, it's the same thing. Polio the virus causes polio the disease, so it doesn't make any difference. Well, just humor me for a minute and ask me that question again, depending on what you think is most important. Okay, well, polio the virus is most important because it causes polio. No, you got to get that out of your head. Ask me which one you think is most important, the disease of juvenile paralysis or the virus? Okay, well, obviously the disease of juvenile paralysis is more important. So how many cases of juvenile paralysis were there around the world? Well, according to the World Health Organization, there were over 100,000. And they said that there were 100,000 cases of polio around the world? Well, no, they call it acute flaccid paralysis. Well, okay, so acute flaccid paralysis is not polio, it's something different, so why are you telling me it's polio? Well, acute flaccid paralysis is polio on the basis of symptoms. There's no distinction between polio paralysis and acute flaccid paralysis, except the presence or absence of the polio virus. So paralysis with the polio virus is a couple of hundred cases a year. Paralysis without the polio virus is 100,000. And, okay, so why is the World Health Organization reporting this, and why have I not heard about this? Well, the World Health Organization has kind of a strange attitude towards acute flaccid paralysis. They believe that a background rate of paralysis, presumably 100,000 cases a year around the world, has been always occurring. And the more cases that they discover, the better their polio surveillance is. So according to the World Health Organization, the more cases of paralysis that are not polio that they discover, the better that it is. If the number of cases go from about 50,000 to about 100,000, which it did over the past few years, then that means they're getting twice as good at discovering cases of polio, and there's fewer cases of polio being missed. But if they're actually always being reporting the majority of the cases of paralysis, then what's happening is a real increase in paralysis. Okay, so what does the World Health Organization say is the cause of acute flaccid paralysis? Well, they came out with a paper in the 1990s, and they said that there's a ton of causes. Other viruses, certain vaccines, pesticides, a whole bunch of things. A lot of things can cause paralysis, so they might not have been right on all the things they listed, but definitely a lot of the causes they listed could cause paralysis. Okay, so why does the world not care about acute flaccid paralysis? 100,000 cases of polio around the world, pardon me, of paralysis around the world, that sounds like a pretty big story. Well, I think it could be seen as Western selfishness, because whatever the cases are, they're not threatening the West in terms of an outbreak of an infectious disease. If it's pesticide poisoning, if it's vaccine adverse reactions, if it's heavy metal poisoning, well, that's not going to spread to the Western world. So basically the Western world doesn't care. I mean, if a kid from Africa came to America, became paralyzed a few days later, and then all of a sudden there's six other people paralyzed in America, then it would be a big story. But as long as there's 100,000 people in the third world, or the non-industrialized world mainly, who are getting paralyzed, nobody cares. And what you also said about the polio vaccine, eliminating polio, well, to go back to that subject, that's definitely not true. What do you mean? Everywhere I read, it says the polio vaccine was one of the greatest successes of modern medicine. It came out sometime in the 1950s, and sometime in the 1950s, polio was eliminated. So, ergo, the polio vaccine eliminated polio. Well, that's not really true. For the first point is the polio vaccine field trial didn't occur until 1954, and the peak of polio cases was in 1952. So the drop from to 1953, which was significant, definitely cannot be credited to the polio vaccine. The polio vaccine also gave the vaccine to about 500,000 American children. And so that's a tiny fraction of the number of children in America, even in 1954. And so, and besides, the vaccine didn't occur until about a third of the way through the year. So it can't really eliminated hardly any of the cases in 1954, even if it was effective. And the rate of polio in America had dropped from the height of 37.2 cases per 100,000 Americans in 1952 to 1.8 in 1960, and still less than half the vulnerable groups had been vaccinated in America by 1960. So the polio had dropped dramatically between 1952 and 1960, and at best, the vaccine could have been responsible for a very small fraction of that decline. So what are you saying about polio then? Like, if the vaccine didn't eliminate it, then what did? Well, polio was always very erratic. There was a huge epidemic, the biggest per capita ever in 1916. What's also interesting is that before 1907, polio reports were only a few hundred a year, and it only really broke out as a significant cause of disease in 1907. And before the late 1800s, it was basically unheard of. And so some people think that it was due to the introduction of chemical pesticides in the late 1800s. And one of those people is a man that I interviewed a little while ago on the question of ultrasound, a very good researcher in New York City named Jim West. And he's looked at the introduction of pesticide sprayers in the late 1800s and the emergence of polio at first in just a few hundred cases, and then we're talking thousands of cases. I'll talk a little bit later about maybe how this worked, but an important point to recognize is that prior to World War II, most pesticides were based on arsenic. There were also some other heavy metals included. And after World War II was a burst of interest in the organochlorines, most famously DDT, and polio started to increase during the Second World War, and then increased to a peak in 1952, and then dropped dramatically. And there's other evidence that polio was environmental as well. The part of the polio field trial, which was published in 1957, was an illustration of the seasonality of polio. What that means is that polio cases increased dramatically in August, or reach a peak in August and September in most places in the Northern Hemisphere. July and October are very high, but the months from about December to May are extremely low. And in some cases, there's a 30 times difference between the summer peak months and the winter months. And this is a very high correlation with the fruit harvest season. There were papers by Gebhardt in 1946 and Toomey in 1933. One of them showed that around the United States, the polio season in multiple states parallels very closely the fruit harvest season. And the other paper shows that this is true around the world. And the only anomaly, which isn't really an anomaly, is that in the Southern Hemisphere, it's at the other end of the year, obviously because fruits are harvested in our winter because of the way the seasons work in the Southern Hemisphere. Okay, well, tell me about this field trial in 1957. Who wrote it, and tell me a little bit about the 1954 field trial that the report was on. Well, one of the problems with the field trial report in 1957 is it was written by Thomas Francis, who was one of the most famous virologists in America, if not the top virologist in America. Well, that doesn't sound like much of a problem. Having a top virologist writing a report on a polio field trial sounds like a good thing. Well, he was also the manager of the field trial, so he wasn't exactly in a position to be critical about the handling of the field trial, since he was basically in charge of reporting on his own work. And so it would be highly unlikely that it would be an incredibly critical report. The report definitely claimed success. There were close to 2 million children involved in the trial. There were about 1,000 cases of polio reported. And the rate amongst those who were intentionally not vaccinated, which means they got placebo or they were not vaccinated at all, was about double the rate amongst those who did receive the experimental vaccine. And this led to rapid approval of the vaccine, although various factors meant that, as I mentioned above, it was quite a few years before everyone who wanted it or was told they needed it got it. But there's quite a few problems with this study. The first problem is that pretty much everybody admits that half the study was a waste of time. What they did was give grade 2 children in certain areas the vaccine, and grade 1 and 3 children received no intervention and were merely observed. This plan was widely criticized because obviously the children are of different ages, the observed students were not individually registered, and this could likely result in underreporting of polio. So scientifically, this is considered an invalid study design, although in defense of the trial, the results that they obtained from this half of the study aren't really that much different from the other half. But I've focused, like most other people, on what's called the placebo-controlled portion of the trial, where half the people were supposed to receive the vaccine and half were supposed to receive a placebo. Now, another problem with the trial is the fact that it measured not only polio as we know it today, a paralytic disease, but also non-paralytic polio. And the symptoms of non-paralytic polio were things like fever, headache, stiff neck, stiff back, sore throat, vomiting, diarrhea, and muscle pain. And also, polio was believed to occur without symptoms, although that wasn't really measured in the trial. One of the problems for the field trial was that the vaccine resulted in no reduction in these non-paralytic symptoms. So this portion of the trial is generally ignored, although it is useful as a check on underreporting, which I'll get to later. So we're left with the placebo-controlled portion and the cases of paralytic polio. This was supposed to also be a blinded, randomized study, but it was actually neither of those. One of the first problems is that the group of children who were not vaccinated was about 330,000, which was bigger than either the group vaccinated or the group that received placebo, which were both about 200,000. So this is a huge group of people who refused the vaccine or didn't show up on the day of the vaccine because they didn't want it or just didn't show up because of some other reason. What's interesting in this group is that the rate of polio was higher in those who received the placebo than in those who received the vaccine. But it was also significantly higher in those who received the placebo than those who received nothing because they didn't show up on the day of the vaccine or because they refused it. And this is very interesting. The report came up with a hypothesis that these people who didn't want to participate in the field trial were less likely to report cases of polio, but the number of cases of non-paralytic polio in those who refused vaccination was pretty much the same as it was in those who were vaccinated or received the placebo, so there's really no evidence that they didn't report paralytic polio. So what's the reason why people who got nothing would have less polio than people who got placebo? Could it be that the placebo could stimulate polio? That's an interesting question, which I'll get to later. The report actually mentioned this theory and dismissed it out of hand. Of course, if the placebo had been able to cause polio, then that would have completely eliminated the validity of the 1954 polio field trial. Well, let's talk to randomization and what randomization is supposed to mean in a clinical trial is if there's two groups of people, A and B, you don't alternate, you know, one person, A gets the old drug, B gets the new drug, or whatever you're testing. What you're supposed to do is each time you add somebody to the trial, you pick a random number and you put people in interventions A or B, or maybe there's more than two interventions or two groups. You do it randomly. So you might have, if you listed the people in the order at which they're enrolled, it might be AAB, ABBB, AA, something like that, which would be a random mixing of people. What the polio field trial did is the people doing the inoculations took out a tube which had enough material for 10 injections. They injected the same material into 10 children, and then they took out a tube with a different ID on it, and they injected the next 10 children. If there weren't 10 children, then presumably they threw out the rest of the vial because it wasn't needed anymore. So you could have in one classroom 10 children getting vaccine and one placebo, or 10 getting placebo and one vaccine. It could have been that this would result in a big imbalance in the number of people getting the two different interventions, but that doesn't appear to be the case. But still, from a scientific point of view, this is clearly not a randomized field trial. Another place where randomization should have been used was that they wanted to get blood from about 2% of the study participants, and then they could study the blood to see who had antibodies to polio, who they were able to culture polio from. And the way they did this was they would pick a school and they would take blood from every student, every participating student at that school. And so they were taking 2% of the schools, or something like 2% of the schools, not 2% of the students. And so the majority of schools had nobody taking blood. And so what the report said While a random sampling of blood from one child in every 50 being vaccinated or observed in the test areas would be desirable, it is practically necessary to confine the taking of samples to children in a limited number of schools. The local health officer, in consultation with the superintendent of schools, will select, quote, typical schools. The choice of schools should provide a good representation of the child population under study in the county with respect to socioeconomic and racial background, urban, rural, and male-female distribution and other necessary demographic conditions. Well, this is all very wonderful in terms of the intentions, but human beings cannot produce random results. Local health officers are much more likely to pick schools that are close by, schools in better neighborhoods where they maybe feel safer or they think that children will be more cooperative. It actually got even worse than that in some areas where doctors would ask for volunteers or doctors would select children who looked like they had, quote, good veins, presumably veins that they could stick a needle into more easily to draw blood. So the blood data from this trial would be even less random than the actual vaccine data. Another issue is what they call blinding. So in a clinical trial, the people who are participating in the trial as patients are not supposed to know if they're getting the treatment or a placebo. In the case of a placebo-controlled trial, or if there's two drugs, A and B, they're not supposed to know if they're getting A or B. But not only are the participants not supposed to know, but nobody is supposed to know except a very small group within the field trial head office that at some point will be able to break the codes open and then analyze the data. But up to that point, nobody's supposed to know. So one of the first problems is that the way vaccines and placebos were distributed was that they were distributed in a box with six tubes. Three had one code and three had a different code. So obviously three were vaccine and three were placebo. And it says in the field trial report that only somebody back at the office known as the Vaccine Evaluation Center, they only knew what the code meant. But actually the codes were trivial to crack. The codes were five digits and two letters. And if the first digits were both even or both odd, then the vial contained vaccine or placebo. And if the first two digits were one odd, one even, and the two letters at the end were in the range A to J, then it was the vaccine. Otherwise, if the two letters at the end were in the range Q to Z, the tube contained placebo. And in every case, the letters were either both in the range A to J or both in the range Q to Z, Q to Z if you're American. So this is an incredibly simple system to crack, and there's some evidence that it was cracked, and it could be that everybody knew about this. That might not have made a lot of difference to the doctors who were injecting, and especially if they're injecting a whole bunch of kids. They just take a tube out, they inject kids, take another tube out, inject kids. They don't have much incentive to say, well, this looks like a healthy kid, let's give him the vaccine. Or this looks like a sick kid, let's give him the vaccine because maybe he needs it more. So it's hard to say whether there's any of that kind of bias, but there may have been considerable bias back in the evaluation of the field trial. Another really important problem with the field trial is that the official study period began 2 weeks after the third injection. In this case, polio vaccine was given through three injections. What was supposed to happen is that the second shot was given 1 week after the first, and the third 5 weeks after the second. So if you add to that the 2 weeks after the third injection, you get an 8-week period during which you weren't supposed to be monitoring for cases of polio. And it says explicitly in the field trial that the 1,012 cases of polio were only collected during this reporting period from about the middle of June up to the last day of 1954. The Vaccine Evaluation Center in May of 1954, which was close to the beginning of the field trial, did ask that all fatal cases of polio be reported immediately. But it's requested particular attention, and that's a quote, be given to cases that occurred within 4 weeks after the last injection. So they want all the cases, but they particularly want the cases within that four-week period. That seems to be giving a subtle signal that if you miss a couple of fatal cases in the early days of giving the vaccine or more than 4 weeks afterwards, then it's no big deal. This study period is a really big problem, because if you give three shots and if a child is allergic to something in the polio vaccine, it's likely to occur after the first shot. And giving an eight-week period during which you're not supposed to be doing monitoring is obviously going to eliminate a lot of those reactions, some of which could be paralytic. Another problem with the trial, it was that it was so huge, there were about 15,000 schools that participated, that monitoring the conduct of the clinics in those 15,000 schools would have been almost impossible. And in actual fact, the Vaccine Evaluation Center didn't even seem to try. They observed 48 clinics. And note that each school, sometimes schools would get together, there would be clinics serving multiple schools. So there weren't 15,000 clinics for each shot of the vaccine, but however many clinics there were, you got to multiply by three, because that's the number of clinics were needed for three shots. And 48 of those clinics were observed by representatives of the clinical trial, which is a vanishingly small fraction. And they sent around some memos in 1954, which indicated there were serious data-gathering problems. The trial took several months. It started towards the end of one school year. It started around April, and it ended in the following school year. So there was tons of time for children to move to another school or change names or many other anomalies that would mean it was difficult to keep track of the kids. Well, David, was there any measuring of side effects of the vaccine? How was it taken by these children? Well, there was a little bit of data from absences from schools. And before I describe that, because the results were actually completely bizarre, let's think about what would happen if you gave a vaccine that was safe and effective to one group, and then to another group you gave an inert placebo or you didn't give them anything. Well, you would expect that the vaccine would cause minor adverse reactions. That's admitted by everybody. Fever, soreness, swelling around the injection site, etc. And so, therefore, the number of school absences should rise in the vaccinated group at least a little bit and then return to normal. On the other hand, those who received the placebo or no injection at all should have no disturbance in their school absence rate. It shouldn't go up or down significantly. And in this case, because the vaccine was claimed to be very specific for one disease, polio, which was not common, there were in fact no absences listed for polio, it would not reduce the risk of absences in the vaccinated group. There would be no health benefits to the vaccine except the prevention of polio. Therefore, the vaccinated group should have a higher risk of absences due to adverse effects and no lower risk, because the benefits would not in the short term reduce school absences. So what did we actually find? So in one group of schools in Pittsburgh, there was a 22.9% absence rate in the first week after vaccination. That's in vaccinated children. 19.6% the second week, then 18.9%, 7.3%, and 1.3%. So from this, you might conclude that there was actually a big problem with side effects from the vaccines, problems that kept a lot of children from school over a 3 or 4 week period. But here's the bizarre part. The children who had not been vaccinated had an even higher absence rate that also declined week by week, weeks after they didn't get vaccinated. Weeks after nothing happened to them, the absence rate went from very high to very low. So why would the absence rate of children who were not vaccinated be 31.5% in the first week after vaccination and drop to 3.5% 4 weeks later? These results justify any possible logic. Now, it's possible that there's something different about the unvaccinated children, especially the ones who refused vaccine. They might be poor or richer, healthier or sicker. There could be differences like that, but that would not produce a high rate of absence that drops over time in parallel with what happened with the vaccinated children. The only other explanation is that somebody faked the data to cover up the fact that there was an extremely high rate of adverse reactions to the vaccination. There was another group of schools, which I think were Catholic schools. They called them parochial schools in Pittsburgh. They showed an absence rate of 14.4% amongst vaccinated children, but 33.3% amongst those who refused vaccination. So that's just crazy. What is it with these children? But I should tell you one thing. The absences, the 33.3% rate of absences amongst those who refused vaccination was for the week before vaccination. So this could say that the group of children who refused vaccination were so different than the group who accepted vaccination that data from them is completely useless and unusable. The weeks following vaccination, the absentee rates in the schools were similar between those vaccinated and those who refused it, and they dropped over time. Again, this makes absolutely no sense, and it's very hard to come up with some plausible explanation for why children who refused vaccination would have such a high absence rate that was highest before they were not vaccinated and then dropped dramatically over the next couple of weeks. Well, maybe there is an explanation. It's possible, for example, children whose parents had refused vaccination might have figured that the school was going to pull a fast one, and so the week at which the vaccinations were to occur, they may have pulled their kids out of school, fearing that the school was going to inject them with a vaccine anyway. But that doesn't explain why the absence rates would follow the pattern of being high after vaccination and then dropping along with the vaccinated children. There was also data from a town called Schenectady, New York, which I cannot pronounce properly. And they provided detailed reasons for absence but did not show the time component. Here the picture is actually quite different and probably closer to what you might expect. The three major groups, each with just over 1,300 students, were those vaccinated, those that received the placebo, and those who refused vaccination. There was a small group that I've ignored, who were those who requested the vaccine but were absent on the day of the clinic. There were only 227 of those. And there were some quite significant differences in the types of absences that were recorded. For example, those who received the placebo had a 1.7% or 1.7% of the absences amongst placebo were due to allergies, and less than half in those who were vaccinated or refused. The refusers had a much higher rate of dental absences. Not sure whether this is a dental appointment or a child who is home with a sore tooth. The placebo had a much higher rate of measles, 3.5% of absences versus 1.4% for those vaccinated and 1% for the refusers. The vaccinated, on the other hand, had higher rates of scarlet fever, sore arm, which of course could be an adverse reaction to the vaccine, sore throat, swollen glands, and whooping cough. Those who were refusers had a much higher rate of stomach ache, non-medical reasons, and no reason given. So this could indicate that the vaccine and placebo side effects were being reported, but as other conditions. There was no category for, I had an adverse reaction to a vaccine that I had. So parents would come up with the best explanation that they could. If there was a list of acceptable excuses from school, they would put it down to whatever they thought that it might be. What's also noticeable is that the number of absence days per student between the vaccine and placebo were actually very similar, 2.2 days on average for the vaccine and 2.3 for the placebo, and only 1.1 for the refusers, which does indicate that the vaccine and the placebo did cause a number of side effects causing withdrawal from school. The trial listed possible reactions to injections. They didn't specify vaccine or placebo, and again, I'll get to exactly what was the placebo later because that's very important. Unexpected elevations in temperature, transient headache, nausea, vomiting, fainting, rash, swelling, numbness, tingling, swelling at the site of inoculation, were adverse reactions that they had reported, although they didn't really seem to have a system for reporting adverse reactions, a very systematic approach. They talked about scattered reports of adverse reactions, but there wasn't really any official channel for reporting them. Okay, one other thing that's interesting about the polio field trial, very interesting, is how was paralytic polio defined? You'd think this would be pretty straightforward. Child can't walk, you know, one arm is dangling down by the side. It should be pretty easy to say where was the paralysis. Was it total, or was it just in one group of muscles, one portion of the body, or not? So what they did, they took a very systematic approach here. They had listed a whole bunch of muscles, and for each muscle, a physiotherapist would provide a score. And the scores went from 0 to well over 200, and the categories were from 1 to 5. And based on the score, they would put you in one of these categories. Category 5 was the most serious form of paralysis. Category 1, however, was scored with 0. So the categories of muscles, each muscle was categorized as normal, good, fair, poor, trace of activity, or no power at all. But an example of a category 1 paralysis is that's given in the report, left quadriceps and right deltoid graded as good. None of the remaining critical muscles affected. No acceptable impairment of other muscles. So what this means is that the lowest level of paralytic polio, the only thing that they found this vaccine for, was for children that, you know, would hardly be classified as paralyzed, certainly not today. They might have had a weak muscle, and when a physiotherapist is looking at a whole bunch of children for the first time without any history, how can they tell if this is just a child who doesn't get a lot of exercise or a child who's paralyzed? There's no necessity to have a paralysis that in any way affects the daily routine of the child. Their description of how the physiotherapist was supposed to grade this was not very clear. A grading of good at the time of either the first or second muscle examination was accepted as significant if it applied to asymmetrical spotty involvement or one or more of 8 muscles characteristically affected by poliomyelitis. So they list those 8 muscles. The patient so affected would be considered paralytic, but because of the good classification, no score would be given to muscular impairment. It would constitute grade 1 spinal paralysis without score. So obviously this has no correlation, no connection to our normal understanding of the word paralysis. Now what was very important in the results was that this category 1 paralysis with a score of 0 occurred very frequently. And so a lot of the results in the 1,012 polio cases that they had, a lot of those were in children who were classified as category 1, no score. So these were children who today probably would not be considered paralyzed at all. And if you took out the large number of children who were considered to be paralyzed from the results might not be significant at all, because the number of paralytic polio cases would drop dramatically. Another important point to make about paralysis is that over time, a lot of this paralysis seemed to disappear. In those who were graded as grade 1, of course, they could only go up. But the majority stayed the same. But amongst, say, grade 3 paralysis, which is getting to be more significant, of 99 cases detected during the first muscle examination, on the second muscle examination a month or two later, only 18 out of the 99 remained at grade 3. 38 downgraded to 2, 27 to grade 1, and 16 to no paralysis. Since grade 1 is very close to no paralysis, that's a pretty significant number of cases where there's supposedly significant paralysis following a field trial dissipated. Whereas our conception of the poliovirus is that once you've got the virus and it's caused paralysis, it's game over. Nothing is going to change. So, David, tell me about this placebo. You've referred to it pretty mysteriously a couple of times. I mean, I would imagine that a placebo in a vaccine trial is like saline solution or something that can be injected completely inertly and therefore has no adverse reactions, but you're saying there are adverse reactions, so maybe that just means that actually there were no adverse reactions in the vaccine, so the reason the level in the placebo is the same is because there's no adverse reactions in either. Well, that's a common misconception, and it appears that in most vaccine field trials, the placebo is kind of like the vaccine without the biological agent, without the live or dead virus materials, or what they believe to be virus materials. They didn't give an exact list of ingredients for the placebo, but they did say that it was based on a substance known as 199, with its pH, its acidity adjusted, and including phenol red, antibiotics, and formalin. There's also a reference to the mercury-containing preservative thimerosal being in the vaccine. And so if the placebo was produced in a similar way, it may well have been in the placebo. There are references to the fact that the placebo was essentially the vaccine without the biological ingredients. And it may just have been that they took the placebo material and put it in one test tube as placebo, and then they put it in with some vaccine to make it with some biologicals to make the actual vaccine. But what this would mean is that the placebo actually contains a higher fraction of some of the potentially toxic compounds, such as the antibiotics, the thimerosal, the phenol red, or whatever. Let's say, for example, if the if nine parts of placebo were combined with one part of biological to produce the vaccine, that would mean that the placebo, which would be 100% of the placebo compound, would have 10% more. What if the vaccine was produced with a 50-50 mix of the placebo with the biological? Then the placebo would have double the concentration of non-biological ingredients such as thimerosal and antibiotics. There's no information given in the field trial report about exactly what the vaccine contained or the placebo. There's some of these references to what was in it, but no reference to quantities. Also, they adjusted the pH of the placebo to get the color to be the same in the vaccine. So they may have had to do more of this to make the placebo look right. And according to one of the manufacturers of phenol red, Sigma Aldrich, phenol red is a moderate skin irritant. So it could have caused adverse reactions in some people. The trial report did admit that the use of a placebo containing potentially toxic materials was a problem. When discussing allergic reactions as reasons for absence for school in Schenectady, they stated, "It is not firmly established that any of these allergic reactions," there were more in the placebo than the vaccine, as I mentioned earlier, "were related to the inoculation, since both vaccine and placebo contained small quantities of penicillin, and the essential differences between the products was the absence of inactivated poliomyelitis virus and kidney protein in the placebo." So it's a pretty clear indication that the placebo was virtually identical to the vaccine without the so-called active ingredient, the inactivated poliovirus, and with somewhat higher quantities of the so-called inert ingredients, which of course are not inert if you're allergic to them or if you're sensitive to, say, mercury or something else. when the field trial got a case of polio, one of the 1,012 cases, they did testing on the blood from these samples, at least in the cases where they could get samples of blood, and they used both antibody testing and so-called isolation. Antibody testing is loved by everybody because it's simple, quick, and cheap, but it can't distinguish between someone who's been exposed and is now immune and someone who's currently fighting an infection or someone who has been immunized. So it's not really clear what value antibody testing has if you step back and think about the virus theory. Virus isolation claims to actually detect active virus in the body, but this is pretty highly questionable because it does not involve purification of the virus, which is the only logical way to prove that the virus is present. But let's look at what some of the numbers were. Out of the 1,012 cases of polio, they collected blood samples for 871, of which antibodies were detected in 433, which is a little bit less than half. In an additional 22 cases which tested negative or tested positive for another virus, a family member was found to be positive, so the case was reported as antibody positive, even though it wasn't. Of the 433 antibody cases out of the 1,000 and so cases of polio, poliovirus was only positively isolated from 156. That's about 15%. An additional 140 were classified as probable or suggestive. So unambiguously positive polio results were only found in 156 out of 871 cases, 19% of those for which both tests were done. Now, if you look at paralytic polio, out of 433 cases, positive antibody tests and virus isolation were found for only 84, which is 23%, which is about the same. Another anomaly that they found were there were 51 antibody negative cases from which virus was isolated, and another 77 antibody negative cases through which virus isolation was probable or suggestive. So the antibodies, although they have a lot of problems, should always be present in somebody who's infected with the polio virus, especially when they've got to the point of paralysis. And yet here you have a bunch of antibody negative cases which supposedly had the virus isolated. But antibody tests had another problem. Nowadays they're generally reported as positive or negative, but antibody tests are actually a continuum. And the way they did it back in the 1950s is they basically diluted serum in by a factor of two. So they mixed serum with an equal quantity of an inert liquid, and then they did it again. And so they would get antibody scores, which were listed as less than 4, 4, 8, and then doubling all the way up to 512 or 1024. The first problem with this is that less than 4 doesn't mean no antibodies. It's just that they can't detect antibodies below 4. And so the lower levels of reaction, even 4, 8, and 16, were also often considered insignificant. So there's really no logical and clear definition of positive versus negative. In addition, the precision was abysmal. When the Vaccine Evaluation Center sent standard samples to over 20 different labs for quantification of antibody levels for standard monkey serum containing polioviruses 1, 2, and 3, they commented that, quote, "The distribution of the average readings is more nearly random than homogeneous," but they claimed victory by saying that laboratories showed remarkably similar standard deviations, which is a measure of variability within a series of measurements, for each virus type and for each control serum, even though the mean readings of the sera differed significantly. This victory was that two-thirds of the readings were no more than a multiple of 5 from the average reading, and that practically all fell within a tenfold range. They also said, "Variations in readings between laboratories on identical sera is largely attributable to their inability to arrive at the same numerical value for a titer or antibody level." So basically, their antibody tests could not be standardized, and so the numbers that they were producing were essentially meaningless because different laboratories would come up with dramatically different numbers. Another strange thing that they found was that there was a certain amount of serum that was called toxic. So they'd take a blood from somebody with polio, and it would kill the cell cultures, so they could not do the virus isolation procedure. Now, some people think that polio is actually a disease of poisoning, so you would think that this would make them wonder whether this child was toxic, that this child was paralyzed because they had been poisoned with DDT or some other pesticide. But of course, since they were so fervent believers in the virus, they just put this aside as a mystery as to why certain blood would cause cell cultures to die. Now, if the Vaccine Evaluation Center had taken a strict definition of polio, two things would have happened. First of all, the number of cases in the study would have been so small that they probably would not have achieved statistical significance, and then the trial would have proved nothing. And secondly, they would have to say that there's a lot of reasons for paralysis other than polio. But we also need to look at the 2% of the children who had blood samples taken without any evidence of polio. They were just taken as this 2% very non-random sample of the whole study population. Of 14,783 blood samples used in the statistical analysis, which was less than half the ones that were actually drawn, a lot of them never made it out of the laboratory or there was something wrong with it along the way, there were 9.8% in the placebo areas that had no measurable antibodies to polio strain 1 before any objections, and 40% of these still had no detectable virus following the entire series of vaccines. So what this means is that surely a polio vaccine should protect the people who started off without polio antibodies, because if people started the study with polio antibodies, they might be immune already. But the polio vaccine, according to this standard, could only protect about half of the people who didn't start with antibodies, which over the entire United States would have been millions of people. It also means that the vaccine might not have been useful at all for people who were already starting with natural antibodies, which generally are seen as better and more effective. If you have natural antibodies to measles, for example, you have lifetime immunity, according to the immunology dogma. But if you are injected with the measles vaccine, you maybe need to be injected multiple times to get immunity that still doesn't last for your lifetime. Okay, well, David, we're coming towards the end of the show, and I'd like you to try to wrap this up. And, you know, what have you learned from this? You know, it doesn't sound like you've finished your research. What more are you going to be looking at? Well, it's very true that I haven't finished the research. There's parts of the report I still haven't really been able to assimilate. It's a huge document, and sometimes I have to flip back and forth between different sections to pull things together. You know, there'll be a little snippet of information here or there, or something I'll read later will make me rethink something that I had read earlier. But first, to summarize what we've learned about polio outside of the trial, the vaccine could not have been the cause of the dramatic drop in cases from 1952 to 1960 because there simply weren't enough people vaccinated, less than half the vulnerable populations by 1960. Secondly, symptoms of polio known as acute flaccid paralysis when the virus isn't found are increasing quite rapidly from about 14,000 cases in 1996 when the World Health Organization started monitoring to over 100,000 in recent years. So polio, the disease, has not gone away. The World Health Organization does agree that some potential causes of acute flaccid paralysis are pesticides or other pollutants, and note that most insecticides in particular are nerve poisons. And also, the seasonality of polio is strong evidence for an environmental cause. Regarding the report, I don't think you can critically review your own work, which is what Thomas Francis did. There were numerous technical flaws in the trial, such as a lack of randomization, although they may have not made a major impact on the data. One serious technical flaw was how easy it would have been to unblind the trial, particularly the Vaccine Evaluation Center where the polio data was analyzed. It would have been easy to preferentially assign polio cases with mixed-up paperwork to the placebo group, even without the bias being intentional. That's why blinding is so important. The symptoms of non-paralytic polio, which I don't believe isn't diagnosed anymore, are suspiciously like intoxication with a pesticide. The placebo was not inert, containing everything in the vaccine except the cell culture extract believed to contain polio. The placebo might have even had higher concentrations of potentially toxic compounds, and that might have explained why those who did not get an injection at all had a lower rate of paralysis, significantly lower than those who got placebo. There was an 8-week period starting with the first injection and extending 2 weeks after the third in which paralysis data was not supposed to be gathered. There was very little quality control. The school absence data is simply unbelievable. And the data from those who didn't get the vaccine might have been manipulated to cover up an extremely high absence rate following vaccination. School absence data from Schenectady, New York, shows double the absence rate in both the vaccinated and placebo versus those who got no shot. And if we understand that the placebo contains potentially toxic ingredients, this makes more sense. Diagnosis of paralytic polio in category 1 with a score of 0 dramatically inflated the number of cases in the study population with what we would not consider paralysis today. Well, David, it doesn't sound like the story's over, but thanks for coming in. This is more interesting than I thought, but I still don't think you've proven that the polio field trial was a failure. Yes, I agree. I haven't proven it yet, but I'll keep working on the report. There are definitely some incredible blunders in the field trial, things that made me gasp when I realized them. They're so bad. But I'd love to come back and finish this discussion of polio another time. Okay, goodbye for now, David. I will have you back on in the future to finish this off. Make sure you bring the coup de grace next time. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to episode 65 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.